When the rain doesn't fall and the streams slow down and you still need water, it's a common remedy to look to groundwater. We drill lots and lots of wells all over the planet. And taking water from deep in the ground comes with some costs. The water from down below is no endless supply, any more than the water from above is. Recent research demonstrates the effects of groundwater pumping on entire water systems, below ground and above. And we have the researchers here to explain their findings, published in a recent issue of the journal Science Advances. Our guests are Laura Condon, Assistant Professor of Hydrology and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Arizona. Laura, thanks for joining us.
Hi.
Reed Maxwell's with us as well, Professor of Hydrology, Geology, and Geological Engineering, and the Director of the Integrated Groundwater Modeling Center at the Colorado School of Mines in Golden. Reed, thank you for joining us, if you're here.
Oh, I think he says he got disconnected.
Oh, okay. We'll try to get him back. Laura, let's start with you then, if you can let us know what was the issue that you wanted to address in this research.
Sure. So basically, we're studying groundwater-surface water interactions, and so we built a really large computer model because we know that groundwater and surface water are connected. That's not really news in hydrology, but no one had ever really studied that across the entire U.S. or the majority of the U.S., which is what we cover. And we wanted to know what were the long-term impacts of 100 years of groundwater declines on our surface water systems across the U.S., so thinking about stream flows and plants, and also to really separate out the impact of those storage losses from all the other things that have happened, because it can be really hard to tell what the impacts of groundwater storage losses are, because at the same time that we've lost all this groundwater, we've also changed land cover and had urban development and done all sorts of irrigation, so that was really our goal.
You're saying 100 years of groundwater decline, though, so we've been watching the aquifers deplete for that long?
Yeah, so we don't have great numbers going back very far, but the study we used from the USGS was actually just less than 100 years, and they were really looking at basically over the 20th century, how much groundwater storage we had before and how much groundwater storage we had at the end, and they estimated that 800 cubic kilometers of water has been lost from the subsurface, so that's about 20 times the volume of Lake Mead.
800 cubic kilometers. I'm trying to do some fast math and get to cubic miles. That's about 500 cubic miles, isn't it?
I'm not positive off the top of my head, but I'll trust you on that.
Well, I'm going 8 times 0.62, yeah. Which gets us close to, close enough. So how prevalent is the use of groundwater for irrigated agriculture, for example, Laura?
It's very common, and it depends where you are in the U.S., whether we're relying on surface water or groundwater, but we use groundwater across the U.S., and we especially rely on groundwater when we have times of surface water storage. So especially during droughts, like the most recent drought in California, we start turning to groundwater more and more when we have surface water is not available.
So it happens in places where natural precipitation at one time was sufficient, perhaps?
Well, it depends on whether natural precipitation is changing or whether our uses have changed. And natural precipitation might be enough during wet periods, but then we can have dry periods where natural precipitation might not be enough.
Reed Maxwell, are you back with us?
I am. Thank you for having me on.
Sure. Good to have you here. So Laura already mentioned that this is a modeling thing. So talk about how you set up the research here to take a look at the situations you were considering for study.
Sure. So models are really good for these kinds of studies because we can do things in models that you can't really do, detect, see in real life. And that is, we can create a world that says, well, what if we didn't pump? What if we never pumped groundwater? And then what if we compare that to what's our best estimate of how much groundwater we have pumped out? And that allows you to do these kinds of analyses that are really hard to tease out in the data because, the data only reflects what we've done, not a way to kind of go back to a baseline of what if we had no groundwater pumping.
So did you try a couple of different scenarios about if we pumped, half the groundwater we have pumped so far, or if we pumped none of the groundwater we pumped so far, pumped twice the groundwater we pumped so far? Did you try different settings like that, basically?
So in more regional studies, we have done exactly that. We've said, okay, what if we pump varying amounts? But this model is pretty big, and it's kind of state-of-the-art and runs on a supercomputer that is situated at the National Energy Supercomputing Center in Berkeley. And so we really kind of only had one shot at this one because it's pretty expensive. It's about 400,000 CPU hours. So if it were one processor running forever, it would be 400,000 hours of time for it to finish. But because we can run this in parallel, it takes about a week, which is still a really big simulation.
Wow, and you're paying by the hour for computing time?
No, fortunately, we get research grants for computing time from the Department of Energy, and so that's been a really valuable way to enable this research.
We're talking about pumping water out of the ground here on the Jefferson Exchange, and some recent research done by Reed Maxwell at the Colorado School of Mines and Laura Condon at Arizona University of Arizona. Whoops, almost called you by the wrong name. That would have been dangerous. You can join us on the exchange as we talk about the effects of groundwater, not just on the aquifers below, but on surface and evapotranspiration. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here and after, we're going to refer to evapotranspiration as ET, but Laura, what is it?
Evapotranspiration is the water that plants are using. I guess that's probably the simplest summary. We don't have to get into more details than that, but that's the water that plants are using, and they can be pulling that from soil moisture, and soil moisture can be connected to groundwater, so that's why we consider it in our studies.
So what are some of the basic findings here at the outset then? I mean, what have you come to realize about the effects of pumping groundwater through these models on both surface water and evapotranspiration?
So I mean, what we really show is that these connections are really widespread across the U.S. That was the point of studying this really large area, that we can see impacts on streams and plants really across the country. But of course, it really depends where you are. So we see bigger impacts where we've had more pumping. We see the biggest impacts on small headwater streams. Those can be really vulnerable. And then we see really strong connections to ET where we have kind of shallow groundwater.
Is there an assumption that some of these water courses on the surface are fed by I mean, they are from groundwater at some point where the water table intersects the surface, right?
So I'll take that one. So the kind of modeling that we do is actually, we call it integrated hydrologic modeling. And what that means is that we don't bake in many assumptions. We try to really limit the assumptions about where water goes, whether it comes from surface water, groundwater, whether plants use shallow groundwater or deeper groundwater or soil moisture. And so that's one of the reasons why this model is so expensive to run, as we say, or takes the amount of computing time it does. But it's really important to try to run these kind of what-if cases, these numerical experiments, without building in assumptions, just like the one you said, that, okay, well, if stream water comes from groundwater, then we're going to get a different answer, or maybe a biased answer, than if we do kind of this more rigorous approach.
You know, we had a guest a couple of years ago, and it was not, you know, we're not talking a science discussion. We talked to Julene Baer about her book, The Ogallala Road, A Memoir of Love and Reckoning, and she was talking about places that she remembers from her childhood in Kansas and Nebraska and Colorado, places where there used to be some fairly sumptuous ponds and things like that are no more. And the assumption from the folks who live there is that this is caused by the pumping of groundwater. Laura Condon, is it that direct a connection?
Yeah, it's a very direct connection. So we can see this if you look at just a single well. You can see cones of depression. So we see the water table being drawn down around where we're pumping. And that can create gradients where we have water flowing from our surface water bodies into the subsurface. So we're basically capturing, would be the term for it. We capture some of our stream flow, or we can capture water that would have been in ponds. And this is definitely true and has been documented across the High Plains, also in places like Tucson, where I live, where we know that there were surface water bodies that were running year-round that aren't there anymore. And we can really directly connect that to groundwater.
That's really interesting. There were surface water bodies, you're saying, that ran year-round, even in Tucson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which has what, like 10 inches of rain a year?
Yeah, not very much around here. I mean, well, we're talking a long time ago, right, before we came and developed these areas. I mean, you can also look at the Central Valley, also looked really different if you go back a long time ago.
Mm-hmm. Again, we're talking to Laura Condon and Reed Maxwell about groundwater effects, pumping water out of the ground and what it does to surface water systems and evapotranspiration. Here's a call from Carter in Wolf Creek. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, good morning. I'm familiar with M. King Hubbard's book, Theory of Groundwater Movement, which at the time was quite imperfect and involved a lot of uncertainties. And The question I have for your guest is, what advances have been made since that book was published?
All right. Thanks for the question, Carter. Why don't you take that, Laura?
Sure. So I think that we know... I'm trying to say the best way how technical to get into this answer, but I think that we have our basic equations for groundwater flow. We know how water moves through porous media pretty well in terms of, like, we solve Richard's equation or Darcy's law. We understand these things very well, that gradients are going to drive flow in the subsurface. But where we're really, I think, seeing the most advancement right now is in how we understand the properties of the subsurface. So we need to know not just, like, what the geology is, but we need to know how those different geologic units transmit water. And so previously we've been able to get that from things like well logs and pumping tests, but now we can start to see that a lot better with things like geophysical methods, and we can actually do that with airborne geophysical methods. So I think where we're starting to do a lot better job of simulating flow in the subsurface is when we're understanding the properties and the configuration of the subsurface better, and less in the, like, evolution of the equations that we're solving.
Airborne geophysical methods, are we talking drones and LIDAR or things like that?
Yeah, actually more like things that are on planes and helicopters, so bigger things. But I'm not an expert in airborne geophysics. So
so do we understand perhaps, I mean, well, let me take about this a different way. I noticed that, you know, where we live, California has only recently instituted some regulations on groundwater, which is pretty amazing for a fairly dry state. But is this the case in places like the Great Plains, too, where there's not a lot of regulation?
Yeah, so the regulation varies a lot from state to state, and I mean, as with surface water regulation varying a lot, I think in most places in the western U.S. there's at least some recognition if you are pumping near a stream that you have to show that you're not impacting senior surface water rights holders. And there's different requirements between states for what counts as pumping near a stream, where you have to prove that, and where you have, how you might have to demonstrate connections to surface water bodies. But I think it varies a lot, and it's definitely not widespread. When we think about just, like, regional groundwater declines, if you have a lot of people pumping across large areas, you can have declines that will impact streams, even if you're not pumping right next to a stream.
So, Laura, did the research end up providing some revelations or more like confirmations of things you had suspected already?
I think that it's mostly a confirmation of things that we had expected, that it wasn't news to find out that groundwater and surface water are connected. But it definitely was really interesting to see how widespread and how dramatic the impact of the groundwater declines were, because it's really, usually we don't get to look at that impact in isolation. So to me, that was the biggest, like, revelation.
Is it as simple as that we are asking too much of our water supplies, that if it's in the ground, it probably is in the ground for a reason and should stay there?
Well, that would imply that we shouldn't use any groundwater ever, and I'm not sure that that's the case. Like, there are ways to use groundwater sustainably, but the implication is that we need to understand more.
And then, Reed, as you looked at the data come back in, all the models, were there any particular surprises in what was represented there?
So I think, to echo Laura's great comments, I think that it was really a lot of confirmation. And particularly confirmation of anecdotal type studies, such as you mentioned, right? So anecdotally, people have recognized that a creek that used to run 50 years ago doesn't run anymore. And while there's the assumption or the hypothesis that it might be groundwater pumping, it's really nice to be able to connect this in a rigorous mathematical way. And I think that's one of the important pieces of this. One of the other surprises is sort of how widespread the pumping impacts are. A lot of prior studies have just looked at pumping right next to a stream or very local kind of interactions. And it's really interesting to see the sort of the widespread, more regional or even almost continental scale impacts. And then the last one is that some of these impacts go downstream. So if you pump upstream, you may reduce flows, but then that gets carried downstream, because at each point when that tributary links into the next stem, it has a little bit less flow, and those impacts are actually carried by the stream, quite some distance.
Had there been some resistance to the science, Reed? I mean, were people insisting, no, me pumping over here doesn't really affect this stream?
So I think that's a tricky question because, groundwater pumping has been so important for irrigated agriculture, and we don't want to imply at all that groundwater pumping is bad or that there's been resistance to this study. It's more that because these studies have been so small scale, because the subsurface is so complex, there's so much what we call subsurface heterogeneity, it's very hard sometimes to attribute pumping in one location to a stream, or you get sort of confounding results locally. And so it's always the challenge of incorporating all of those kinds of heterogeneities in the large scale.
Laura Condon, there's a bit in the paper that indicates that slowing or stopping groundwater irrigation does not necessarily make a difference. I mean, if you got the water pumped out of the aquifer, it doesn't necessarily come back, or at least it doesn't come back quickly, I gather.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that was one of the reasons why we wanted to look at groundwater storage losses in isolation, because groundwater is really a unique part of our system in that it's the slowest moving part of our hydrologic cycle. And so if we have changes, if we change storage in the subsurface or deplete it greatly, it's going to take a really, really long time to recover from that, some places more quickly than others. So that was really the point of separating groundwater pumping and groundwater losses from irrigation, is that we can change our irrigation practices. Between this year and next year, we could irrigate differently or change our crop choices, but the lasting impacts of decades and decades of depletion will take a really long time to recover from. So that's really why we wanted to focus on groundwater.
So how would you like to see people use the research then that you've presented here and move ahead and do things in changing perhaps water practices?
I think that really the point of our study is to raise awareness about these connections and to show that if we're thinking about groundwater storage losses, we don't need to just think about whether we're going to be running out of groundwater. There's a lot of talk about, like, okay, well, when would we run out? How much can we use whether we'll run out or not? But if you actually want to think about sustainable groundwater management, that you need to think about also maintaining good connections to streams and the role that groundwater is playing in supporting plant water use through ET. So really just thinking about it more holistically.
All right. It's not just the water down in the ground is just the water in the ground. It also affects surface water and other water it's a whole water ecosystem out there, I think is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Laura Condon, Assistant Professor of Hydrology and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Arizona, Tucson, thank you. Reed Maxwell, Professor of Hydrology, Geology, and Geological Engineering, and Director of the Integrated Groundwater Modeling Center at the Colorado School of Mines, thank you. Good to have you both on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks.
Thanks very much.
Take care.